This episode is brought to you by the Grace Enough podcast, where host Amber Cullum and her guests delve into hard truths and the unwavering grace of God while journeying in the kingdom of God here on earth. Listen every week at graceenoughpodcast.com or on your favorite listening app.
You're listening to Quick to Listen. Each week, we go beyond hashtags and hot takes to discuss a major cultural event. I'm Morgan Lee, an associate digital media producer here at Christianity Today, and I'm joined by Ted Olson, our editorial director.
Hey, Morgan.
What up, Ted?
A lot. It's really good to be back on the show. Love that Mark's still traveling. So there you go. You're traveling, too.
I am headed to Nashville this week.
Nice. For the Q conference.
Yeah.
I will be staying here editing copy.
Ted, you could have gone to these conferences.
I could have. No. I've been to Q. It's a fun conference. It's like TED Talks for Christians. It's good.
More or less, yes. And I'm sure I'll come back with a report for everyone next week. It may even be a precious moment. Who do we have on the show today?
We have Sandra Morgan. She is the director of the Global Center for Women and Justice at Vanguard University. That's a Christian university in Costa Mesa, California. She's been involved in the fight against human trafficking for lots of years, first as a nurse in Athens, Greece, more recently as administrator of the Orange County Human Trafficking Task Force. She created Vanguard's anti-human trafficking online certificate program, and she hosts the podcast Ending Human Trafficking. Another podcaster to join us today.
Hey, Sandra.
Thank you. It's so great to meet both of you.
How long have you been in the podcast space for?
About 5.5 years.
Oh, wow. Yeah, over here, just 2 years. So
it's a whole new culture. Fortunately, I had a great teacher and my co-host, Dave Stachowiak, who has a veteran podcaster with Coaching for Leaders.
Have you enjoyed being part of this medium?
I absolutely love it. I get questions from all over the world. I get to impact how people are working to end human trafficking in cities I will never visit and with people in disciplines that are so different than my own. So it is a fantastic medium.
Completely agree. All right, well, let's get into our topic today, which, judging by your credentials, I think our listeners may have a little bit of an idea about what we're going to be chatting about. So last week, the U.S. government shut down the classified advertising website Backpage.com on allegations that the site was profiting off of illegal prostitution. As of last Friday, users visiting are greeted with a message explaining that the website and its affiliates were seized as part of a joint project by the FBI, Post Office, and IRS. Online classifieds have long been criticized for facilitating sex trafficking. In 2010, human rights activists called Craigslist the, quote, biggest online hub for selling women against their will. In 2012, New York Times columnist Nick Kristof called Backpage, quote, a godsend to pimps, allowing customers to order a girl online as if she were a pizza. Evangelical Christians were among those who praised the Backpage.com shutdown, and sex trafficking is one of the movement's main social causes. But some critics denounced the government's decision to shut down Backpage.com. Some cite free speech concerns and say websites shouldn't be responsible for what users post there. Other critics say the Backpage shutdown makes life more dangerous for people in prostitution. This week on Quick to Listen, we'd like to discuss the challenges that confront Christians when they fight sex trafficking domestically. So before we get into our discussion today, just another time to remind everyone that this podcast is totally possible by all of you who subscribe to Christianity Today, the magazine. So Ted, in one of our most recent issues, we had this interesting article about prayer.
Yeah, it's called Are We Praying Too Casually? An issue or two ago, we had a really interesting column by the recording artist Sandra McCracken on conversational prayer and how important it has been for her just to start, you know, this unceasing prayer where you're just constantly reminded that you're walking with Jesus and you can talk to him even about very mundane things in a very conversational way. The kind of flip side of that is this article from David Thomas, who noted, you know, how rarely you see kind of super casual prayer in Scripture, and noting how much kind of intentional, very longing, what he calls travailing prayer, has preceded periods of revival, and then just how we can pray in very intentional intentional ways.
I really like this piece because of just the different, you know, sometimes you read different passages of scripture that are put together in a different category than you've seen before or a different bucket. And then there's just more fascinating juxtapositions that are there. And I thought that this piece did one of those things. And it also kind of had the effect of me being like, oh, this is something I would want to do with a Christian community that I'm a part of. Not necessarily something that I would feel like, oh, I'd want to do myself. In fact, that conversational piece that you talked about by Sandra seemed like, oh, that's something that would change how I would live my life. Whereas this one seemed like, oh, I want to enter into a community differently when we start praying about things.
Right. There's this great phrase in there about chosen desperation that hit me and I've thought about since reading this piece on CT, where it's not a kind of manufactured, like you're trying to like create certain emotions, but there's this acknowledgement, this kind of come Holy Spirit, come Lord Jesus idea that you do see a lot in scripture, and to enter into that kind of biblical longing and that biblical desperation to see God work in our lives and in our communities that we, you know, in an everyday mode can forget about how deep that longing should be for us without trying to manufacture emotional feelings about it.
So if you would like to read more about this idea of whether or not we are praying too casually, you can do that by becoming a subscriber of Christianity Today magazine, and you can do that by going to orderct.com/quicktolisten, orderct.com/quicktolisten. All right, Ted, so now is the time of the show that you and I often give gut checks or our instantaneous reactions to this particular piece of news. So go for it.
You know, one gut check was, I'm really surprised the Backpage has survived as long as it has. In your intro, quoted a number of years-old op-eds in here. There have been a lot of people trying to see the end of Backpage. This is a website, you know, that came out of kind of the those alt-weeklies that you used to see more common in the 90s and early 2000s, those kind of free giveaway newspapers that came out. People have been trying to get rid of this for a very long time, so it was good to see finally the government doing something about it. And then I was a little bit surprised to see a little bit of the backlash. I mean, of course, one of the reasons we're talking about this is because a lot of people were very upset with a tweet from the organizers of the Women's March who criticized the government for shutting down Backpage. We argue that Backpage should exist as a safe haven for sex workers.
I would say that, you know, this Nick Kristof piece from 2012, part of the reason I like added that to the intro was because I was like, oh, didn't Nick Kristof write something about this? Maybe he has something interesting. And of course, Nick Kristof considers himself progressive and someone who cares deeply about social justice. And I thought it was important to provide the fact that there are many progressive people who aren't Christians who also had anger with what Backpage was going on, and the fact that, you know, again, a lot of people have been calling on this for a while. So some of this like backlash did take me a little bit by surprise, even though I've seen a number of articles on more progressive sites in recent years trying to talk about sex work and its place in these things. Having said all of that, though, I think I did have the same reaction to you a little bit, which is like, wait, what? This is still an issue? Like, If Nick Kristof was writing these types of things for, you know, maybe the nation's premier newspaper outlet 6 years ago, this is still a thing, really?
Yeah, it's not like it was like the Silk Road, where it's like this, you know, black website, hard to track down, and who's really behind this. Like, no, we know who's behind this. We know where their servers are. We know who's running it. Why is this still running?
All right, so maybe that's our question to you, Sandra. What was taking the government so long to crack down on this website?
After the government shut down the exotic ads in Craigslist a few years ago, a lot of the Backpage business moved to, what do they call those, offshore type business models, so that we wouldn't have access to them for investigation. And I really want to remind both of you and the audience that this big news thing that has happened with arresting the CEO and some of the employees and everything, actually the law was passed and has to be signed into law, which I think might be happening even as we're recording. But the these arrests were part of a 93-count indictment with a full range of money laundering crimes, as well as facilitating prostitution and interstate foreign commerce conspiracy, and so on and so on and so on. So these are related issues, but it's not entirely black and white. It isn't against sex workers. It is against the exploitation and fostering a business model that isn't legal. When we posted the new law on our Global Center for Women and Justice Facebook page, I wrote, "Good news, one more step in interrupting the business plan traffickers use to exploit their victims. But this won't stop them alone. We need to reduce demand, identify vulnerable people, and intervene before they're trafficked." So Backpage is just a symptom of a much bigger issue. And already several of the other online services of a similar ilk have already shut down some of their sites as well with regard to prostitution ads.
So you just talked about Backpage as being a business plan for traffickers. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah. Traffickers do business on the street. They do business. They do business on the dark web as well. But the opportunities to use existing highways such as Backpage and some of these other types of websites is part of their business plan. If you're launching, "I'm going to sell a widget," you're going to find a place to sell it from. When Craigslist shut down some of their exotic ads, it didn't take the people, the business people, the traffickers are business people, and about 40% are women and about 60% men, according to some of the latest research. So that's why I'm being careful about pronouns, because I don't want people to have stereotyped images as they listen to us. But I want them to understand that as soon as this business plan shuts down, they're going to find another way to do the same business.
Like you said, after the Craigslist shut down, that they instituted new policies to try to not get caught in the same area. From reading the some parts of the indictment, it seems like the folks at Backpage were pretty involved in even editing some of the ads so as not to directly say prostitution or any kind of keywords that would trigger federal action.
Yeah, I think though the federal aspect, there isn't a federal law against prostitution. Those are state laws. And so when people are pointing at the federal government for that aspect of it, that's not really their responsibility. It's California has a law, Nevada has some little spots where they have legalized commercial sex. And then there's some places on the East Coast. But generally, these are the states that have been clamoring to be able to clamp down on the easy access to do their business of trafficking for commercial sex right in our backyards. And we have no ability to monitor or curb that.
Because of the fact that it's the internet, correct?
Right, right. You've probably had conversations with Ernie Allen, who was the CEO retired from National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And he often makes the analogy that when we had the car and the crooks had the money to get the cars first before the cops did. And so they said, "Outlaw cars because our horses can't catch them. We just have to catch up to the times." And equipping and finding ways to manage the internet highway is part of how we do a better job of protecting our communities from a law enforcement perspective.
So you had said that it's very likely that many of the traffickers, now that they're shut out of using Backpage, will find other opportunities. And so given that, how significant is this decision?
Oh, this is a huge decision because it is not just about Backpage getting shut down. It's about a legislative package that allows states and victims to fight online sex trafficking. This, with the Stop and Ape, they added the SESTA amendment. And so this is going to give victims access to doing lawsuits against these business practices, these people who have benefited by advertising, so that they can go after them for restitution, retribution, those kinds of lawsuits. So there's a lot more to it than just the back page website.
You're talking about the Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act or FOSTA?
SOSTA and SESTA, which those are the laws that just passed. And because the arrest at Backpage and all of this was connected, I'm afraid that more of the attention has gone on the sensational side of Backpage and not enough attention on what is going to happen, because now we have resources that our state and our victims can use.
So maybe you can tell us a little bit about what the legislative landscape looked like before this legislation passed, so people can have an idea of what the status quo was.
When they added the amendment to the CDA, the Common Decency Act, which, by the way, in the House passed 388-25. And so something controversial wouldn't get that kind of vote.
Sure.
So there was a lot of support for this.
Especially not in 2018, right?
No, exactly. Exactly. The vital CDA changes, though, were changes that had been gutted from the FOSTA. And so putting them back in through the SESTA, the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act, and I love the word enabling because it just embodies so much that we need to be more aware of. The key alterations then are the right to pursue civil rights of action and that to the sex trafficking victims, and state attorney generals are empowered to bring prosecutions. I deal a lot with survivors and conversations with them. And so many times we have lots of government funding, state, county, and federal, that provides for the prosecution of the traffickers. And we have some resources for support and protection of the victims. But as far as victims receiving any kind of real compensation for the pain they've endured, those kinds of civil lawsuits are very far and few between because they're so hard to complete. And so this law is going to change the landscape for victims. And I believe that one of the reasons so many other websites of a similar ilk shut down their prostitution ads is because of the fear of these huge lawsuits against them by the victims, not just the access that states would have.
So before, if I had been someone that was trafficked, my ability to sue someone for the damages that caused on that, I didn't have any standing in court.
Right, right. You would have, it would be very, very difficult. There's a handful of cases, especially of civil lawsuits for damages. And this now would hold the people advertising responsible for providing that platform for this kind of exploitation.
This episode is brought to you by the Grace Enough podcast. I am its host, Amber Cullum. Each week, I sit down with a guest to discuss hard truths and the unwavering grace of God they've experienced while journeying in God's kingdom here on earth. You'll hear from guests like Jen Wilkin, Jamie Ivey, Andy Crouch, and Scott McKnight. Listen to these conversations and more by searching Grace Enough Podcast on your favorite listening app or by visiting graceenoughpodcast.com.
So, you know, in recent years, we've seen local governments increasingly adopt legislation that prosecutes those who are purchasing sex, or in this case, facilitating the purchase of sex.
As opposed to prosecuting the prostitutes themselves, is
correct?
What you're saying.
Yeah.
Right.
Or the sexually exploited populations. What has led to the change in philosophy?
I think the more we begin to understand the role of demand in this triangle, it's really the law of supply and demand. You have a product and you have a supplier. If there's no demand, the business goes away. That's why they don't usually sell snow cones in Alaska. So the focus on who the sex purchasers are has become a real valuable asset in ending human trafficking, in as far as sexual trafficking, because if there is no demand, the suppliers don't come to your community. One of our task force law enforcement officers, Sergeant Juan Reveles, loves to tell people that they've actually got evidence from pimps' phones that says, don't get caught in Orange County, you'll go to jail. And the idea that you can actually interrupt the law of supply and demand by arresting the sex purchasers, arresting the traffickers, and making it, creating a climate that does not support and their business can't thrive.
When did you start to see this shift first occur?
Oh, our task force started kind of at the end of 2004, really got into full swing with funding in 2006, 2008. But I think we started to see this real shift in 2010. And Westminster Police Department Deputy Chief Derek Marsh was really a leader in looking at the demand side of finding the sex purchasers and making sure they got more than a slap on the wrist or a parking fine, but actually arresting them. There are several district attorneys across the U.S. that do the shame board. I'm not exactly sure how I feel about it because it does create quite a deterrent, but they actually put the faces of those who are arrested and convicted of sex purchasing on their district attorney websites. For me, you know, I have redemption in the back of my mind for every person. And so I want to do the best I can to get them on the right track. But certainly having legal repercussions, consequences for purchasing something that is not supposed to be sold. That's the direction that we've taken in Orange County. And back to the back page selling sex. We use the term human trafficking because it's in the same category of crime as trafficking in weapons and trafficking in drugs. And if you put an ad that you could buy such and such a weapon on back page, the FBI, Homeland Security, they would be at your doorstep in minutes. Same thing. If you're going to be selling drugs, selling it out there, it's contraband. And selling people is not okay.
You're at a Christian university. You know, from our perspective here at Christianity Today, sex trafficking, human trafficking in kind of broad strokes, but specifically sex trafficking has been, you know, one of these issues that has just become really big in recent years, especially among kind of millennials over the last decade and other college students. I mean, it seems like whenever I would talk to a college student for a while, you know, almost, you know, probably two out of three said, oh, I want to go work for, you know, International Justice Mission after I graduated. It was just really popular. I am curious if you're still seeing that at a place like Vanguard, if you're seeing there's still high interest among college students and Christians in general about getting involved in advocacy on sex trafficking.
On my campus, we have a campus club. I learned early on that if you don't provide a viable model for students, they will go out and create their own before they've actually studied the issues and learned how to do something that's going to be effective. So we created Live to Free and Making Just Choices Change Lives. And our students now have been leaders in youth prevention for almost 10 years. They present in high schools and at conferences in our county to do prevention with young people so that they understand the risks when they meet somebody in the mall that they met online and those sort of things. But the students are looking for ways to be significant, not just do busy work until they get through their education. So they do volunteer in social services, in children's programs. They also do internships in our community. And in the last few years, they've become huge advocates on labor trafficking because 68% of trafficking internationally, according to our own health and human services statistics, is labor trafficking. And so four of our students were scholarship to attend the most recent Fair Trade Conference in Washington, D.C. last month. And their claim to fame is that they have been the leaders to make Vanguard University a fair trade university, the first in our county. And the idea that, 20% of the world's cotton is produced in Uzbekistan, where children aren't in school sometimes, many times, the lowest socioeconomic group, they're working on cotton plantations. And then when they don't get an education and they get old enough, then they become vulnerable for being commercially sexually exploited and sex trafficked. So the connections between labor trafficking, sexual exploitation, and sex trafficking are very connected. And this generation has a much more holistic view, and they want to make a difference in community development, community advocacy. They're very eager to mentor kids in the foster system because they believe that one person doing one thing can make a difference.
Has it been an uphill road trying to get people who are mobilized on sex trafficking to also care about labor trafficking?
Yes. And let me tell you, you could make me cry right now, because that is one of my real burdens, to use, church language. Labor trafficking is slavery. And I travel a lot and I hear horrible stories of children who are forced to work in mines and things like that. And then I find out those are products that I'm buying, and I have no understanding of how my choices are impacting someone else's life. But I've had so many people say to me, well, they're only being labor trafficked. It's not like sex trafficking. But for many of these children, when they are in that kind of forced labor situation, they are sexually assaulted. And their dignity, they aren't called by their name. We had one very high profile case in Orange County of a little girl who was brought here from Egypt as a child maid. And they called her stupid. They didn't call her name. And so that whole idea of dignity, of imago Dei, you're created in the image of God. Somehow we have to resurrect our value for people created in the image of God, regardless of what is happening against them. And it's just as important to rescue them, to restore them, and to stop that kind of exploitation of people. And in 2008, when the Trafficking Victims Protection Act was reauthorized, the Department of Labor was mandated to create a report every 2 years that shows where products that you buy and I buy came from, and if there was child labor or forced labor involved in that product. They have an app. It's the Sweat and Toil app. So when you go to the grocery store, you can actually see that these bananas were picked by children in this country. So I'm just not going to buy that. I'm going to drive demand for ethically produced products. And I think this generation of university students, they understand that language. They study corporate social responsibility. They choose where they're going to work by the corporate social responsibility policies. And California passed the Supply Chain Transparency Act in 2010, which makes me really proud, but I'd like them to put some teeth into it. But we have to start asking those questions, not only of where things come from, but what choices am I making that contribute to the problem?
I'm curious, how is fighting trafficking here in the U.S. unique compared to overseas?
Oh my goodness, we have so many resources. I often do training in other places, and I'm really careful not to overstate this is what you should do, because they don't have the same resources we have. Just for an example, in Orange County, we have 276 sex trafficking convictions since 2013. We've served more than 700 trafficking victims. To do those 276 convictions, we have 6 vertical prosecutors in our district attorney's office. That means that's all they do. Well, if you have a small office, like, for instance, in Athens, Greece, with a small task force that has to cover the entire country, you're not going to have the same resources to be able to do the kind of investigation and work that has to go on to get those kind of convictions. You have to train judges and you have to train victim advocates. It's a very arduous task and expensive.
I'm curious, when we look at the advocacy world, or at least the advocacy community around this issue here in the United States, would you say that evangelicals have a fair amount of clout in that world?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. When I became the administrator of the Orange County Human Trafficking Task Force, I had been a volunteer and I had a loosely organized church community committee that supported a lot of the activities. But when I became the administrator, we created our own, a separate committee for the churches. And I just, that continues to thrive and support advocacy and city councils, county government, school administrations, and statewide efforts. And that's not a small number. The last time I talked to our volunteer coordinator, we had over 400 volunteers on our task force, and over 90% from our churches. So they drove the social will for supporting and continuing the activities of the Orange County Human Trafficking Task Force.
You know, some would say that it's possible to work in the sex trade under your own volition, and others would say that anyone who participates is inherently oppressed. What would you say to these arguments?
There are those who made this choice that this is a lucrative business. But when we talk about sex workers and their right, understanding that in our legal system, prostitution is generally not a legal activity. That being said, I've followed countries where they have legalized prostitution with the idea that it would free people to be able to pursue this as a profession. But the research shows that that does mask then those that are there against their will or because of coercion and manipulation. And so it does then allow human trafficking to be invisible in that community. And so there are problems with that as well. And based on research that I've done and research I've read, there is usually a precursor to moving in this direction. There's a research psychologist in San Francisco by the name of Dr. Melissa Farley. And in her research, she not only has produced white papers on the myths of legalizing prostitution, because that would be the agenda of the sex workers. That's what their hopes are. But she's also done research to show that most women, because we're talking women mostly here, but this does, prostitution does include men. And then, of course, girls and boys are commercially sexually exploited, which is very different from prostitution. That particular aspect of choice is a little bit of a muddied line, because if they were sexually exploited as a child and then turned 18, they didn't suddenly, as an adult, make a choice to be in this business. And so how are we defining that? How are we giving people options to get out when they come of age? And they're not just trapped in that lifestyle. I am confident that there are a great number of people who are working in commercial sexual exploitation, selling commercial sex acts, that really would love to be doing something else if they had that opportunity. And some people say, this is my choice because they want to save face. Other people truly believe when you start working with them, they go to counseling, that they aren't good for anything else. This is their lot in life. They come from a culture where it's very fatalistic. And there are so many consequences to a culture and to families that I feel we have to be taking a step back and finding out, not that we're going to be against people of any ilk, but that we find out what their story is, how they got here, and see them as created in the image of God. And that is where I believe the church needs to plant our feet and see these people in our lives and in our communities.
Thank you so much for that. That was good, Sandra.
Thanks, Sandy.
As a reminder, you can leave feedback to us via Twitter. We're at CT Podcast. We also now have an email address, which is podcasts@christianitytoday.com. So you can let us know all your different rebuttals and counterarguments over there. All right, now is the time of the show we call Precious Moments, which is when we ask everyone to share something that has brought them joy in the past week. Ted.
This last weekend, on Friday, my kids' school had multicultural night, which this is the first, you know, they've had multicultural day during the school day. This is the first time they brought it into the evening, and really encouraged parents to participate. And it was an amazing time of actually getting to know other parents in the school. It's a small school. It's easy to get to know parents, generally speaking. But we have a lot of first-generation immigrants in our school. We have a lot of refugees. And the parents in those communities tend to bunch together, generally speaking, a lot of them for language reasons. And it's just been very difficult to connect. This, because it was kind of like, tell us about your community and let's celebrate. It was just so easy to connect and have good conversations with folks that I've been wanting to connect with for you know, in some cases for years, and to start to develop those friendships and to kind of meet my kids' friends' parents. And I was just really excited and thinking a little bit about what are some ways we could, you know, apply some of this to the church. Because honestly, our school has been trying to do this for a long time, but just honestly tweaking it a little bit, saying let's make it an evening activity rather than an after-school activity or school day activity. Let's ask the parents to present stuff rather than have the kids present stuff. It made a huge difference. And let me say, the food was amazing because everyone wanted to show like a cool food thing from their community. And we had some great eats that day.
Cool. That's really awesome, Ted. Are you online at all?
I am. I'm at Ted Olson.
Awesome. All right, Sandra.
Okay. So we live in an old house built in 1951. And about 6 months ago, I found out that the windows are not tempered glass. And we have a glass patio door. And I'm a nurse. And all I've done is stay away from my door. Yesterday, we had all new windows put in. And I can hardly wait to have guests. And I don't have to worry if the kids are running.
That's awesome. That's cool. And getting windows in is a pretty big project, too.
Oh, it is. It is. So I have to cook for my husband or something.
You know it.
And I do cook Greek food, so he'll be really happy when I do that for him.
Where can people find you? Do you have any books or a website or social media?
Well, they can find us at the Vanguard Global Center for Women and Justice on Facebook and on Instagram, endinghumantrafficking.org. Org is the website for our podcast, and it's only 30 minutes, and it's a great way to learn more about it from whatever your perspective. And you can always email GCWJ, Global Center for Women and Justice, that's what those initials are, GCWJ@vanguard.edu.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Sandy. That's great. All right. Well, my precious moment this week is that I went to the Milwaukee Art Museum on Sunday.
Oh, I've never been.
I've seen it a lot and I've never walked in. It has a very iconic shell, I guess, or structure.
What do they have inside, collection-wise?
They have actually a lot of 20th century pieces, and they had this really amazing piece of glass. I'm going to try to my best to explain it. So the piece of glass jutted out in three directions, and on the one part of the glass, it was transparent, And then on as you walked the other direction, because it was this like giant piece of glass that you could like walk around, it became a mirror.
Oh, cool.
So it was really weird to just kind of like you'd start in the middle and you'd see a reflection of yourself, and then you'd walk out and you could see through it. So we took like some pictures where it looks like one of my friends is staring into the mirror, but instead she sees me on the other end.
That's cool.
Yeah, and they had some like other interesting pieces there as well. I think in general the Art Institute in Chicago, it has some contemporary stuff, but not as much as I would really like. And they also had some elements of like just design. They had a bunch of like chairs, for instance, and other like products that they incorporated in there. And they also had Haitian art as well. So that was really cool. People can find me online on Twitter at MEPAYNL. All right, well, that is it for us this week. Thank you again to everyone for listening to another episode of Quick to Listen. This episode is produced by myself, Richard Clark, and Cray Allred. You can find this podcast on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Overcast, etc., etc. This podcast is made possible by everyone who subscribes to Christianity Today magazine, which, again, you can become a subscriber at goingtoorderct.com/quicktolisten. See you all next week.